the crowd loud. This pumping rhythm is hitting. We want to make it clear. We ain't scared. This is the vision we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's show, May Day History and Holding the Police State Accountable Past to Present, from Kent State to Baltimore. Our first guest is musicologist T.M. Scruggs. He'll share a little about the history of May Day and play relevant music for the occasion. Luis Santoyo joins the show to tell us about International Workers' Day events. Independent journalist Jeff Davidian shares a recent victory in his quest to ensure citizens have the right to film police for accountability. And Laurel Krauss and Joseph Lewis join the show to discuss the 45th anniversary of the Kent State shootings. Please stay with us.
About a criminal mind, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the ties with a master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. We have a packed show for you today. We'll be talking about May Day history. Also, of course, we'll be talking about holding the police state accountable past to present from Kent State to Baltimore. And our first guest today is musicologist T.M. Scruggs. T.M. Scruggs is also on the board of Media Freedom Foundation and Project Censored, and he is also involved with The Real News, and T.M. might be able to mention a little bit about that as well. But he's here today to share with us May Day music. T.M., tell us about this.
Well, happy May Day, everybody. It's Workers' Day. I know Jimmy Carter tried to make it Law Day, but it's really Workers' Day, and they became named Workers' Day after the attempts to unionize in Chicago, and the police came in and arrested people and eventually illegally executed folks. And because of that, in solidarity, all the way over in Europe, they declared May 1st to be declared a day to celebrate the rights of workers. So can we just jump right in to celebrate workers and the power that union gives you? By a more recent version of a song that goes way back, Solidarity Forever. This version's by Tom Morello and the Night Watchman.
Inspiration through the workers' blood shall run. There can be no greater power anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
It is the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. Now we stand outcast and starving, it's the wonders we have made, but the union makes us strong. A single wheel can turn. We can break their haughty power, gain our freedom when we learn that the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
In
enemies magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old. For the union makes us strong. Hey!
All right, TM Scruggs, tell us a little bit about that song, and what are we going to play next in celebration for May Day here?
Yeah, well, we can send that out to the Longshoremen. Thank you for helping to organize a true May Day celebration in Oakland. Well, the next one is There's Power in a Union, and this is by this version is by Billy Bragg, who is an English singer-songwriter and performer who has really helped keep the issue of labor alive. And let me just put in here, how does all this fit into Project Censored? Well, when is the last time you heard that song on any radio? And nothing that these four songs we're going to play today has ever makes it on corporate radio at any time. So it's all censored in that sense. And yet it's all an important part of our history. So let's listen to There Is Power in a Union.
TM Scruggs in studio with us today on the Project Censored Show, celebrating May Day and celebrating May Day music. What do we have for us next here, TM Scruggs?
Well, a song that, you know, used to be a lot better known, the International. And a lot of people associate with the Soviet Union because long after the fact, it was adopted by them as the national anthem. But originally, this stems from the rising of the workers in France, the 1871 Commune. And it was written during the Commune by Eugène Potier, just the words. And they used to sing it to the song of the Marseillaise. Da-da-da-da-da-da, right? And I remember reading about him, he was hiding out during the repression afterwards, but he did survive. And then later, about 12 years later, a man named Pierre de Getter, who was French also, composed new music for it. And eventually he was recognized way back in the 1920s and was taken to the Soviet Union and honored and everything. But the words are all about power to the workers and the coming of a better world controlled from the bottom up. And this version is done by Ann Feeney, who's a great singer from Pittsburgh.
Arise, ye prisoners of starvation. Arise, ye rattled of the earth. For justice thunders condemnation. A better world's in birth. No more tradition's reign shall bind us. Arise, ye slaves, no more in thrall. The earth shall rise on new foundations. Judgment wall. We workers ask not for their favors. Let us consult for all to make the thief distort his booty, to free the spirit from itself. We must ourselves decide our duty. We must decide and do.
T.M. Scruggs, right on. Right. And we have one more we're going to play in celebration of May Day and radical workers' music here. Mm-hmm. And tell us about this last clip. Tell us about it.
Well, it's a tune that you may not recognize from this version, but it's the Marseillaise, which was written commemorating the storming of the Bastille that liberated political prisoners and led to the French Revolution. And the joke is that just as anything can be co-opted, you know, the Marseillaise was co-opted as being the national anthem of the very bourgeois capitalist Republic of France, and so is the national anthem. Well, everyone knows the first part of it. And the joke is that when people have to sing it at a soccer stadium, they start by saying, two arms, and then no one knows the rest of it. And so the wonderful singer-songwriter Serge Gainsbourg, who was the first well-known popular figure who was known to be Jewish, you know, out as being Jewish, and received a lot of racial hatred within France, especially outside of Paris, because of that. He had a hilarious song that was completely censored in France, even though it was extremely popular. It's a reggae version, and the chorus is saying, Assange, etc., two arms, etc. And then he speaks over the rest of the words of it.
Here we go.
Sly and Robbie.
La patrie, le jour de gloire est arrivé. Contre nous, la tyrannie, l'étendard sanglant de l'élevé. Entendez-vous dans nos campagnes ce soldat, ils viennent
brancher nos fils, nos compagnons. Amour sacré de la patrie, conduit, soutient nos braves enjeux. Liberté, liberté chérie, combat avec tes défenseurs. Nous entrerons dans la carrière. Nos aînés n'y seront plus, nous y trouverons leur poussière et la trace de leur vertu.
So, TM, that was
Serge Gainsbourg's version of La Marseillaise.
All right. So, we have kicked off the May Day Project Censored celebration with some music, and that has been brought to us by musicologist TM Scruggs. TM also very prominent activist on the board of Project Censored. Also, The Real News. Quickly tell our listeners about The Real News.
Yeah, sure. I'm an executive producer with TheRealNews.com. We actually have that URL. And our studios opened up last year are in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And so we have been ideally placed and have already done a lot of coverage of especially the black community in Baltimore. So I encourage you all to make your way to TheRealNews.com for a lot of background information and including some live streaming of events as they unfold.
Okay, TM Scruggs, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing music and solidarity for May Day. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Up next, we're going to hear from Luis Santoya with the North Bay Organizing Project and the events in Santa Rosa, the May Day March there. Luis, are you with us?
I'm here. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure and an honor.
It's great to have you on. Now, this is not just International Workers' Day, but the May Day marches are covering a number of different issues. Police accountability, social justice in Mexico, immigrant rights, homelessness. Tell us about what your plans are today.
We are planning to gather in Santa Rosa, as you mentioned, at the site of a former Albertsons, and it's right in the middle of Roseland in Santa Rosa. It's known as a Latino neighborhood in the city, and from there we're going to start marching to Courthouse Square, downtown Santa Rosa, for a brief rally with speeches, including some union members and other workers who will be talking about their struggles in the area, and then we're marching back to the same location in Roseland for another rally, some music, some food. And there will be organizations from the area who will be tabling and reaching out to folks and hopefully recruiting new members as well. So far we have a lot of organizations who have confirmed their participation. We'll have the North Bay Labor Council there, us, of course, North Bay Jobs with Justice, Unite Here, who organize hotel and casino workers, among other industries. We'll have the Committee for Social Justice in Mexico. We'll have KBBF 89.1 FM, which is a bilingual station, as you know, and some student groups as well. Some college student groups will be there.
Luis, that sounds like a great day. This is one of many hundreds of May Day events happening around the world, capitals all over the world, and, of course, here in Oakland and other places in the United States and Santa Rosa. So thank you very much for being on, Luis.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Police accountability, that's certainly an issue, and it's happening in Baltimore. It's happening everywhere. And our next guest is Jeff Davidian, who's a journalist from Milwaukee, a member of the Project Censored National Judging Group, has been involved with us for many, many years. And Jeff has a story to tell about filming police and the difficulties that he had and the lawsuit that resulted from that. Jeff.
Peter, thank you. About 4 years ago, I got a call that the police had blocked off a street in Milwaukee because a squad car failed to stop when it entered the street and broadsided a car that was just driving by. And by the time I got down there, there were 8 police cars, a photographer, an investigator, the detectives, the supervisor, and they had kept the woman who was hit, the victim, standing outside for an hour and a half while they took pictures and measured the scene. When I got there, I started taking, at first, still photographs and then video recording. The police, and they told me that I was interfering with them by videotaping. But I said, I'm a reporter, I'm not interfering. And one cop came up to me and he put his hand over the camera, twisted it out of my hand, broke it, and cited me for interfering with the issuance of a citation. Well, I fought that ticket. And I went to court. I'm going to say I went 10 times to a municipal court for $180, but I wanted to get the cops on the record, and I wanted to get a court reporter and take their testimony and show that it had been a violation of civil rights. When it came time for the trial, though, none of the police officers showed up to testify, and the judge didn't show up. So they dismissed my case. But I said, wait a minute, I don't want it dismissed. I want a trial. I have a right to a trial. I've been here 10 times. I've brought a court reporter with me that I've paid. And in Wisconsin, under Wisconsin law, you have to ask the judge for permission to appeal, and they refused. So I went and I filed a federal civil rights claim alleging that the citation was a way to get me to stop filming. And they settled it finally for several thousand dollars. It's not like they beat me to death, but you know what? I stood up to them, and there's a record now of this police officer having done this. And the only way really to stop this in Baltimore or Missouri or wherever the next instance is if somebody captures it and documents it and there's a record of it. Even Rodney King, who was the first recorded beating by the police, those cops got off. So even when you get the documentation, at some time is not enough, but it will not happen without it. So anybody can do this. I'm available to tell anybody what I did and how to go about it. It's pretty straightforward. You go, you make your claims, and you have the right to create a record that the next person can use when they sue.
Well, Jeff Davidian, this isn't the first time you've been doing this on a number of other related areas, and where you're using the system to try to hold people accountable.
That's what the system is for, isn't it? The court system is not just for corporations to sue on copyright, and it's for you when your rights are violated to take action. I've sued banks. I've sued municipalities. A municipality in Tennessee hacked the website on which I stored stories that I wrote about them, and they settled that lawsuit. And with that money, I went and I brought another suit. So you have to fund yourself as you go, and at some point, they start to say, well, you're just litigious. They just like to sue. And I say, yeah, but you keep beating people. Or you know, so, I mean, it's...
Maybe when they stop violating people's rights, you'll stop suing.
You would think so. But the problem, I'm freelancing now. I've been with a number of newspapers. But as a freelancer, I don't have a corporation to come in and to defend my rights. Not that they do. The corporation, the corporate news agencies defend their own rights. But for the individual journalist... If you get your camera broken, the newspaper will call the police chief and there'll be some resolution. But it's your rights that were violated. It's not the newspapers. And reporters need to go and do their own suits because through these suits you get discovery. You get to get documents and you get to take depositions and have them swear under oath what happened. And that is a great tool for any reporter to be able to force under oath the person you're investigating to answer questions. So if I can help anybody else,
Jeff, you have helped establish the right of individuals to film police and the public in daily activity. And that's certainly starting to make a difference around the country with cell phones and people doing that. That's certainly a very important thing. You're also a very strong advocate freedom of information from public agencies. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yes, I am. I have brought federal civil rights claims against municipalities because the government is obviously, and the people in it, first of all, on the front lines, they don't know what the Public Records Act is. They always put the most stupid person there that you have to go to, and they say, I don't know, no, you can't have that. And then you have to instruct each of them in turn on what it is that you want. At some point, you just get tired of it, and you want to just enforce your right. If the public doesn't know, have the right to those records, you don't know what the government is doing. And to be familiar with the Public Records Act and what you're entitled to is a very powerful piece of knowledge because you'd be surprised how much stuff gets covered up because they just don't make the records available to you. Every state has a procedure for getting public records, and the government is required to make them available. You can also get them from corporations. You can't just ask for them like you can, but if you get a phony charge on your bank statement, you can sue. You can say, how many other people has this happened to? If you're inclined to be a champion of everybody else that has the problem that you do, and you want to deal with it in your turn, well, you can bring a suit and try to remedy it on your own. Because if you're waiting for the district attorney or the state attorney general, not until it's politically popular is that going to happen.
Well, when it comes to government records, there's very little that isn't public. Is that correct? I mean, there's some personnel things, there's claims of national security. But other than that, I mean, we should be able to access them.
Each law, each state sets out in its Public Records Act what you're entitled to and the way to go about it. You're right. Most stuff is supposed to be public, but you have to know what it is to ask for it. And if you don't know what it is and you want to know what there is, they say, well, specifically what do you want? And you say, well, I don't know because I don't know what you have. Then you can ask for the directory of the records that you have. What are the categories? What are the fields that you populate in order to maintain your records? And that way you can get a sense of what it is that they keep. The investigative reporters and editors at the University of Missouri has a program and books available to inform everybody how to go about getting the records that you want and what needs to be available. You're right. There are some personnel files are not available, and sometimes you have to sue. But if you sue, they pay the legal fees if you win.
Jeff Davidian, you've offered here a couple times that you would be interested in talking to people or helping to talk, you know, people figure out how you do this and how they can do this. Do you have a way then that people can contact you or a website, some way that people can do this?
I can give you an email address that you can, anybody that's got this problem and wants to know what I did, and I'm not a lawyer, I can't give you legal advice, but the email address would be geoff@milwaukeepress.net, and that is milwaukeepress.net.
Mm-hmm. So Jeff@milwaukeepress.net.
Right.
And also for listeners, the ACLU has recently released a new application for iOS and Android called Mobile Justice. You can learn more at mobilejustice.org, but this is something that you can actually use to record the police, and it streams the data, so even if your phone is taken or destroyed, the video footage remains.
That is a great improvement over what had before that been a great app, and that was from the New Jersey ACLU that gave you the chance to secretly record, but then you had to send it afterwards. And if they got your phone, they might not be able to find it, but if you hadn't transmitted it, it would not be available.
Okay, Jeff Davidian, thanks so much for that information. I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned to Pacifica Radio. This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We'll be back talking more about May Day and the police state past and present after this musical break. Stay with us.
Damn you don't, another shift to bed, suburb of my bed coming on. Hard to imagine I'm working in mines, got coal dust in your lungs, on your skin and on your mind. Yeah, well I've listened to the speeches, and it occurred to me, politicians don't understand.
Scott Heron, 3 miles down. That music was brought to us by T.M. Scruggs, who's on the program earlier today with Mayday Music. We were just speaking with Jeff Davidian about police accountability and the encroaching police state. And for the remainder of the show here today, we're joined by Laurel Krause, and we'll also be joined by Joseph Lewis. We are going to be talking about the 45th anniversary of the Kent State shootings, or the Kent State shootings were on May 4th, 1970. Laurel Krause has been a longtime activist for justice at Kent State, founder of the Kent State Truth Tribunal, also is published with us at Project Censored on the murders at Kent State. We'll be talking about that here again today. We're also joined by Joseph Lewis, who was one of the victims of the Kent State shootings and was actually shot twice by Guards members, and he will be talking a little bit about his story. But Laurel Krause, welcome. It's great to see you. You're actually on your way to Kent for the 45th anniversary, so tell us about that.
Well, I'm on my way to Kent, Ohio for the 45th anniversary.
You've actually written prepared remarks for the 45th anniversary. Flowers are better than bullets, right? So we're going to post that on the Project Censored page as well. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Basically, Kent State invited me to speak for Allison this year. Allison Krause, my sister, was one of four students that was killed. There were nine wounded. Allison said less than 24 hours before her killing, "What's the matter with peace? Flowers are better than bullets." And so the speech that I'm giving is entitled "Flowers Are Better Than Bullets."
Right. And we're going to talk a little bit more in detail about some of the updates regarding the Kent State massacre. Certainly, we've published a couple years ago some of the new information that came out of forensic reports, and we want to find out more about your trip to the United Nations and talk about what was stated there about the Kent State shootings. Joseph Lewis, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Joseph Lewis, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to join us from Ohio. You were one of the victims there that day, and you were actually shot not once, but twice. Could you recount some of that narrative for us, particularly some of the information that came out in court?
Well, a couple of important points that I'd like to make is that the guardsmen had no really legitimate, there was no truth to the claim that they fired in fear for their lives, and anyone who was there and saw what happened, like I did, and even like the guardsmen did, know that there was no reason for them to be afraid for their lives and no reason to shoot, especially the four students who were murdered that day. They were all 250 or 300 or more feet from the line of guardsmen and certainly posed no threat. Myself, I was the closest one shot to the guardsmen. And I was motionless and silent and 65 feet away, standing still watching them as we thought they were returning back to where they started from, up over the top of the hill in front of Taylor Hall and then back down to the commons behind the Taylor Hall. But as I watched them, they kept glancing back over their shoulders at the Prentice Hall parking lot area where there had been a lot of vocal engagement and hollering from the students at the guardsmen. And suddenly, I as I watched them climb the hill, when the first three guardsmen got to the railing in front of Taylor Hall, they simultaneously turned in the same direction, aimed their guns, at which point I gave them the finger, and they started firing. And I was shot within a couple of seconds. I never would have imagined that they needed to shoot, or never would have believed that they needed to have their weapons loaded with live ammunition. So the claim that they were in fear for their lives is really bogus. And the other important fact that I'd like to point out that I know from firsthand experience is that on Monday, May 4th, there was no riot by students at Kent State. In spite of many press reports that I read that contradicted that, the press reports talked about students throwing bricks and bottles and overturning cars, and that was simply not true. It was fabricated after the event to justify the shooting, when in fact, it was a peaceful assembly, and you don't have to take my word for it, because this shooting and cover-up happened in front of the School of Journalism, which was Taylor Hall on Kent State's campus, and so there were dozens of photographers present, and there are hundreds of photographs since it happened in broad daylight. And so you can examine the photographs and understand very quickly that the guardsmen didn't need to be afraid for their lives. And there was no student riot on that day. There was no violent activity. No guardsmen were hurt. There was no violent activity on the part of the students.
Joseph Lewis, I actually did my graduate thesis on the shootings, particularly about the commemorations. And one of the things that I focused on was the construction of the gymnasium annex that students fought there. But it makes it appear as though now, well after the fact, in 1977, 7 years later, made it appear as though that the guard was somehow hemmed in, and it was a further justification for the official narrative. Saying that the guard had no choice but to shoot. And as you're saying, the photo evidence of that day clearly indicates otherwise.
Yeah, it's absolutely not true that they had fixed bayonets, they had tear gas, they had helmets, they had rifle butts, you know, as well as loaded guns, which we didn't ever expect. There was no way they had to be afraid of students who were not dressed for battle. I mean, I had on moccasins that day, and as I said, I was motionless and silent watching them. We all thought they were returning the way they had come, and there was no need for them to shoot. They were not hemmed in. And in fact, the argument that the guard makes for, some of the guardsmen make for having to shoot is even shown to be untrue, because only about a dozen or two dozen of the 76 guardsmen on the hill even fired at all. Most of the guardsmen weren't even, you know, involved in the shooting. There was a couple dozen individuals who, I think by a predetermined decision, when they got to the top of the hill, turned, aimed, and fired. And there is absolutely no justification or no support for the fact that it was a spontaneous event. Tape recordings made at the time, although from a distance, seemed to indicate that there was a non-military style order to fire by someone in their rank. And the fact that they turned in unison tells me there was one of two things happened. Either they had a predetermined decision that when you get to the top of this hill, at the corner of that railing, we will turn and teach these dissenters a lesson, or there was an order to fire that told them that at that moment they should turn, aim, and fire. And so the truth of the matter is that there was no reason for guardsmen to shoot that day.
And Joseph Lewis, we're going to get to that with Laurel Krause here in a moment and the forensic evidence analyzed by Stuart Allen. And we've had that on the program here before. But I just wanted, while we have you on the line, you were shot twice. And so you were hit by a guardsman once. And then as you were wounded on the ground, you were purposely targeted again, according to testimony. Is that correct?
Exactly true. And the names of the guardsmen are available. They testified. The first guy testified that he shot someone, and he described a person with sandy hair who was giving him the finger, but he couldn't see what was in my other hand. He said he thought I might have a weapon, mm-hmm. which of course wasn't true. But the second guy in our federal civil trial in Cleveland in the summer of 1975 testified in open court with the jury present that he shot at me after I was shot, convulsing on the ground. Our lawyers, you know, were blown away by that. And so they incredulously looked around at the jury, and then they asked him the question, so if he was already shot, why did you shoot him? And that individual responded that in this very droll way, he thought that everyone else was shooting him. That was his response to an attempted murder question. Everyone else was shooting him, and they got away with this. Both of these men admitted to shooting me, an unarmed person, motionless, silent, and got away with not only shooting and wounding me, but killing four others at a great distance. And after being sequestered for 30 days, came up with the story that they were all in fear for their lives. Now, military standards would require each individual to have the serial number of the rifle that he used recorded, and the number of rounds given to them recorded, and the number of rounds returned recorded, so that it would be very clear who fired which weapon and how many times. Unfortunately, that information was not available, was hidden away and destroyed. And in fact, my understanding that the M1 Garand rifles that were used at Kent State to kill four students and wound nine others were subsequently shipped to Bosnia and lost all contact with. So, you know, not only is it against moral and legal restrictions, but it's also violated the military's own policy.
Well, it's for sure that there were plenty of violations that day, and you were armed with free speech and a middle finger. Hardly a reason for you to be shot and then shot again while on the ground peacefully protesting after you were already wounded. I mean, that's, again, just an incredible, incredible story, Joseph Lewis, and I thank you for taking time out to share that 45 years ago that this happened. And we're going to turn here to Laurel Krause to talk a little bit about a few things that you brought up, Joe. And, of course, this is about the order to fire, the turn to fire. And, of course, Laurel Krause, you've been very active on this front for a number of years after Stuart Allen and the forensics analysis came out of the Struba tape.
Yes, long story short, Emily Kunstler and I founded the Kent State Truth Tribunal in the 40th anniversary year. And as we closed our doors at the first tribunal, which was held at the 40th anniversary in Kent, Ohio, May 1234, where we collected first-person narratives, witnesses, and participants of the Kent State Massacre. We got over 60 testimonials over those 4 days, and I returned home, and the headlines broke that a tape recording from a student's window ledge had been analyzed for the first time digitally by a forensic expert. His name is Stuart Allen. It was front page of the Cleveland Plain Dealer at the end of the week, May 8th, 2010. And it was 40 years later that all of a sudden we had a lot more evidence. The first evidence that came forth was that there was an order to shoot that had been denied by multiple facets of the government for over 40 years. All different groups said that there was not an order to fire, so that leads me to believe that there was collusion. But beyond that, he kept looking at the tape, and this Stuart Allen, he's a forensic evidence expert. He's highly credited. He's internationally accredited for forensics. And so he was taking this tape, and he could make it go faster and slower and more sound and less sound, and he plays it like it's an instrument.
But he's done work for the government. I mean, he's been all around. He's done this for ages.
He's very, very sought after. He's extremely busy. He's soon to retire. But we were lucky enough to have him take a look at this. And I didn't even know he was doing it. It just broke on its own, which was magnificent. And he ended up pulling out 4 low-caliber pistol shots 70 seconds before the command to fire. And when he matched the sounds of the low-caliber pistol shot, it matched up another pistol that had been collected on May 4th by the police. There was also photographic and video evidence showing a man with a pistol running across campus into the hands of the guardsmen, mm-hmm. a shiny pistol. And he was a student at Kent State University studying law enforcement, but he was also taking pictures, and he had a gas mask.
And was this Terry Norman?
Yes. It's Terry Norman, and he's been a person of interest since May 4th, but he's never really answered any questions related to it. And it leads us to believe that he created the sound of sniper fire, which then prompted the order to fire.
Well, Laurel Krauss, we are going to take a musical break, and then we're going to come back and talk more about this issue and Terry Norman, and also about the your trip to not just the UN, but also the International Criminal Court.
No, we went to the United Nations Human Rights Committee in Geneva.
In Geneva, right. So we'll be back after this musical break, and we'll talk more about Kent State with Laurel Krauss and Joe Lewis. Stay with us. Listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Right now on the program, we're talking about the 45th anniversary of the Kent State shootings. We're talking with Laurel Krauss, longtime Kent State activist, also a founder of the Kent State Truth Tribunal. And we're also joined by Joseph Lewis, who was shot twice by the guardsmen at Kent State. Of course, Laurel Krauss's sister, Allison, was one of the 4 slain. And we're talking about information that's come out in the last several years about audible orders to fire, about possible sniper fire by a man by the name of Terry Norman, who it turns out was actually somebody affiliated and associated with the FBI. This was corroborated, of course, after the event. Joseph Lewis, you're still with us by phone?
Yes, I am.
You heard what we were just talking about here. Do you have anything you want to add, particularly about Terry Norman and the provocateurs on campus? A number of years ago, we talked with Elaine Wellen, a sociologist who was on campus that day, and she claimed that she was at the ROTC building and that the building had been on fire, but basically that there was nobody there to set it on fire, and they were essentially, you know, talking about this issue before it happened. So there's several different instances at Kent State where there were possible provocateurs involved. Do you know much about this?
I'd like to comment about the ROTC fire, and I believe provocateurs burned that building down. I was at the edge of a crowd. Near the front of the crowd, the people were trying and made several unsuccessful attempts to ignite the building, and then the leaders of the crowd said, let's go around camps and try to get some more followers, and I followed behind that group. And when we got to around the front of the Kent State campus, that's when the National Guard came in from Ravenna to the east. And so I ran back towards the area of my dormitory, which is right across the commons from the ROTC building. And at that time, it was fully involved in flames. Now, it's a very hidden fact that there was a list of possible people to be indicted about that ROTC fire and people interfering with firemen. And that information is not readily available. But during the course of our civil trial, I fell in love with and later married Galen Keller, who was a principal investigator for the legal team during our civil trial. And she had access to all the documents. This is before computers, of course, and so everything was on paper. She had access to boxes and boxes of all the documents, of all the testimony, to all the different investigative bodies by everyone involved. And she found some radio logs that seemed to indicate that the firemen who were waiting at the stadium were told not to come. Even though there was a fire, they were told not to come and hold off. And I think that shows, as Laura talked about collusion, I think that shows some kind of collusion on the part of law enforcement that night, and perhaps the presence of provocateurs, which is further supported by what she told me, that there was a list of potential indictees submitted to the feds of people who may have been involved in the arson and interfering with firemen. And after it was reviewed by the feds, the two people on the top of the list who were most culpable for potential crimes against the building and the firemen were removed from the list. And to me, this indicates that these two people were being protected by the federal government. And it can only mean to me that they were agent provocateurs. Now, Terry Norman, we know, had an FBI connection. And Laurel and I have a slight disagreement over the fact of the timing of the shot, 70 seconds before the fusillade, to me, is not a substitute for sniper fire, but it's an indication of something else, I think, because that long a period of time to wait wouldn't be in the nature of their excuse to fire. So I'm a little confused about the timing of the shots from Terry Norman being so far before the 13-second fusillade by the National Guardsmen, and I don't know what exactly the connection is there, except I know that Terry Norman was seen with a pistol. And in the interviews with TV news reporters, they said that the pistol had been fired.
Joe Lewis, hi. This is Peter Phillips. Your story about the ROTC building and the transcripts is collaborated by Elaine Willen, Professor Elaine Willen, who teaches at Sonoma State. She was there. She came out of the sociology offices. She's a grad student. And she saw plainclothes men with walkie-talkies near the ROTC building speaking into the mic saying, "Don't send the fire trucks yet. We can't get the fire started." So
yeah,
that she testified to that 2 years ago on our show. That certainly collaborates what you're saying.
Yeah, and I think that the fix was in. I think that the Nixon administration and the Rhodes administration were trying to send a message to dissenters that dissent would not be tolerated if it didn't agree with government policy. And I think this was a turning point because if you remember, shortly after Kent State, the large anti-war protests that continued across the country, after universities across the country were shut down in a national student strike, the first and only national student strike, that protesters in New York City were attacked by hard hat workers in the city who beat up the anti-war demonstrators while the Wall Street workers applauded. And I think this was a brilliant strategy by the Nixon administration to divide the country and to take what were formerly would have been perhaps Democratic supporters, the union workers, and turn them against the students and others who were dissenting with government policy and objecting to the continued war in Vietnam. And I think this was a strategy that they employed and intended to employ and got the results that they wanted.
And Joe Lewis, thank you for your joining the Project Censored Show today. And Laurel Krauss, I wanted to go up to the present here with you. You mentioned the UN and the fact that you had taken this case to the United Nations. Can you tell us a little bit about that and where it stands now in the last couple minutes we have here?
Yes, I took Kent State to the United Nations Human Rights Committee March 2014. Our submission was given. We had two members raise questions and comments about Kent State related to command responsibility, using deadly force, and what happens when new evidence shows up 40 years later. The U.S. responded and said in 1970, four students were killed, were murdered. And I have that on my T-shirt that I'm wearing right now. It's a commemorative T-shirt that we have available at truthtribunal.org, which is the website for Kent State Truth Tribunal. And basically, it's the first time that the United States government has ever admitted to killing and murder at Kent State. And the reason why this is important is because they have treated it as a civil matter for 45 years. It's been sued. It's been a civil case. But the reality is four people died and nine people, it was attempted murder on them. And it should be treated as a criminal case with federal charges.
This is a big development. I know you've been working on this for some time, and this is the most recent, was when you're taking this to the UN, and people can learn more about your work with Kent State, of course, at the Truth Tribunal, but where else?
The best way to follow us is on Facebook. If you go to facebook.com/Kent State Truth Tribunal, you're going to actually have to type that in because there are some efforts to censor our work. Mm-hmm. And so if you go facebook.com/Kent State Truth Tribunal and like us, you can follow everything I'm posting every day, and there's a lot of activity. I just filed my response report to the United States. The UN takes a long time. That's what I've learned. And so the process, we're still very involved, and we're looking forward to major movement forward in 2015.
Laurel Krauss, thank you so much for your tireless work here. And so in terms of trying to get justice, what happened at Kent State now 45 years ago, very important work. We're certainly following and supporting it here at Project Censored. So thanks so much for joining us.
And my speech that I'm going to be giving on Monday, May 4th, will be on the Project Censored website.
Right.
And so anyone can read it. It's going to be actually in a lot of places. And I hope that everyone will read Flowers Are Better Than Bullets.
Thank you very much, Laura.
One of those places will be our memorial for the Kent State shootings at Sonoma State University on Monday of the 4th as well. And we'll be reading your letter there that day.
I'd like to thank everybody for tuning in today to the Project Censored Show. We air on over 20 stations around the U.S. And for more information or to listen to archives of previous shows, go to www.projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Anthony Fest is our producer. Pedro Reyes is our engineer. And I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. And we will see you next time.
We want. Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cars that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of it, our brothers and our sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We got that love of it, your brothers and your sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We got the love of it, our brothers and our sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We got the love of it, our brothers and our sisters. The people organized can build the kind of future we want.
Unthinkable times, stakes is high. Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds. Political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys. And the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Times running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love with our brothers and our sisters.